Lecture S 57. Lecture 57, May 11, 1964, Semiconductors.
Developments in physics in recent years has been, of course, nuclear energy. But another remarkable and dramatic development has been the application of solid-state science to technical developments in electrical equipment and so on, in the form of transistors and other devices. It is now, it is as a result of the study of semiconductors that the properties of these substances were discovered and a large number of possible applications were found. Things are changing every day, and I'll tell you the applications up to the latest moment. But it's perfectly obvious that by continuing studying these materials, there will be new and more wonderful things to make and to be able to do as time goes on. This lecture is, of course, not necessary. It's just for your own interest in telling you about these things so that you know at least that some of the things you're learning about have got something to do with something. And so I'll discuss the semiconductors. There are large numbers of semiconductors, but I'll concentrate on those which have the greatest amount of technical applications, because on understanding those, and those are in fact the ones that are best understood, we get a great deal of understanding of any of the others. The most important substances that are used are silicon and germanium and related substances. These elements form in a diamond pattern, a diamond lattice, and they are neutral insulating materials at zero temperature. They're not metals. At zero temperature, however, we can imagine that we put an extra electron into the lattice, and this electron can then wander about and be on one location or the other. It has an amplitude that jumps from one location to another, and so there's a whole band of energies associated with this electron, or as it is sometimes called, negative carrier. In addition, this band is the same mathematical business that we described before. In addition, it's possible to remove an electron from the silicon or the germanium lattice at zero temperature and find that the missing object has a certain amplitude to move to another location. Of course, what's really moving is an electron which leaves a bubble or a hole that moves around from place to place, and therefore it also has a band of possible energies. We'll only be dealing with the lowest possible energy, so that in the electron case, we are working near the bottom of the band, in which case the energy is approximately quadratic in the momentum, in the K vector. And in the same manner, we'll work near the edge of the band of holes. Now, it's conventional to represent this thing a little bit upside down because people understood it originally differently than I've explained it. So they make an energy level diagram that looks something like this, which you'll find in various books. It goes like this. Here represents the bottom of the band of electrons in energy, and an electron or negative carrier may be indicated by an N here, and it can have higher states. We don't worry about going to the top because we're working with low energy. Then, down here, plotted upside down, is the energy of the electrons, or rather of the holes. The reason is that the holes were originally understood as missing electron, and the discussion was made that all of these bands back down here were filled up ordinarily, and that when you took one out, an electron out of this energy level, you were making a hole. So they think upside down. The holes are positive charges which move here, but whose energy has been plotted upside down, if you don't mind. Finally, it is possible, you say, at a given circumstance now, if we were to put some electrons in the upper band, they would move about much like a gas. If there aren't too many of them, the interaction between them is not important. And if you put an electric field across the material, the electrons would drift across and would be collected by the electrode. And that would be the end of it, because there would be no new source of electrons. However, on drifting across, they wouldn't go as free particles, but would suffer collisions with the lattice, with irregularities, lattice defects, and impurities, which all of which we will discuss. Now, as I indicated, there would be, at zero temperature, neither electrons nor holes. The same thing would happen, of course, if I put holes in and disappear with the electric field. If we come to finite temperature, however, a possibility arises. It is possible that an electron jump out of a nice, happy position that it is at one atom site and go off and wander around. When it wanders around, it's a negative charge. The place that it left behind is a hole. So it is possible spontaneously through thermal fluctuations or in any other way, or in many other ways rather, to create a pair of an electron and a hole. This requires a certain energy, and this diagram has been made so that that energy is indicated here and is sometimes called the energy of the gap. It requires a certain energy, E gap, to produce a pair, an electron and a hole, which N and P, negative and positive carriers of electricity. If the temperature is not too low, the probability of creating such a thing, of course, of such a pair, the creation due to fluctuations, will be proportional, as you well know, to the energy required, or E to the minus the energy required over KT. So the probability of producing a pair spontaneously will go as with temperature this way. At zero temperature, there's no appreciable probability, but as the temperature rises, there is a relatively increasing probability of producing such pairs. Now, actually, if this were all there were to it, at any finite temperature, this is the rate of production, and the rate of production would continue forever, and we would get more and more negative and positive charges. Of course, that doesn't happen, because after a while, we have a number of these negative carriers and holes wandering about, and there is a certain probability per second that a hole meets a positive charge, a positive carrier, an electron meets a hole, in other words, and the two things annihilate each other again. Well, the rate at which this will happen will undoubtedly be proportional to the number of electrons or negative carriers per cubic centimeter and the number of positive carriers per cubic centimeter, because the number of collisions is mutually proportional to the number of each kind. Therefore, you see that the number of negative multiplied by the number of positive carriers is some constant times E to the minus the energy of a gap over KT. When I say constant, I mean nearly constant. Later, perhaps in this lecture or at some other time, we can deduce exactly what this constant is. It's slightly dependent on temperature, but of course the major dependence on temperature is here. It means that the product of these two is given this way. Thus, for example, if the material is originally neutral in an ordinary sense, as you would expect, and the pure material, and you had a finite temperature, then the number of positives and negatives must be equal. Why? Because if not, the thing would not be neutral. And we make these pairs, we make the same number of both. And under those circumstances, the number of intrinsic carriers that are negative, also the number that are positive, are both equal and vary as E to the minus the gap energy over 2 KT, which is a rapid rise. The variations in many properties of the superconductor, the conductivity, for example, and so on, is mainly determined by this factor, because all the other factors vary slowly, while this factor varies very rapidly. The gap energies are something like 72 hundredths of a volt in germanium, 1.1 volts in silicon. And they get larger in other materials. In cadmium sulfide, which is a semiconductor of a different crystal type, the voltage difference is 2.4. For diamonds, which is in the same crystal type, it's in the neighborhood of 6 or 7 volts. So high in the case of diamonds is this exponential, because KT, you remember, is a 40th of a volt. So 6 volts, even divided by 2 is 3. And then divided by a 40th is 120. E to the minus 120 is 0 for all practical purposes. So that diamond doesn't work very well directly as a semiconductor at finite temperature. Whereas for the smaller gaps of 72 hundredths of a volt or 1.1 volt for germanium and silicon, the material will be an intrinsic conductor. By that is meant that if the pure material is used and electrodes are put across it, you will find a conductivity. The reason? There are negative and positive carriers present in equilibrium, and they drift in the influence of the electric field. Incidentally, there are other ways of making pairs. For instance, suppose that the gap were higher, or even that the conditions of temperature lower, in such a way that the intrinsic conductivity is very low because the number of carriers is very low. Under those circumstances, it's also possible to excite or to create carriers, for example, by light. Light of the wavelength equal to the separation between these here, between these, can knock an electron out of an atom and make it drift about. That leaves a hole behind and a moving electron. And so we can produce negative and positive carriers in number proportional, at a rate proportional to the intensity of light. And if we draw them off with electrodes, we'll get a current, because once they hit the electrode, they're finished. We'll get a current that's proportional to the intensity of light, and this is the explanation of the phenomenon of photoconductivity. In the same way, if a fast-moving particle moves through such a crystal with a large gap at low temperature and or at low temperature, then the particle in going through will knock some electrons out of the crystal, out of the normal condition, leaving holes and electrons behind, which can then be collected by electrodes on opposite sides of the crystal, and that is the mechanism of crystal counters for counting radioactive particles. Neither of those really require what's called a semiconductor. They'll both, strictly speaking, work in insulators. As a matter of fact, there's no complete distinction between insulators and semiconductors. It depends upon how semi is semi. As you vary the temperature, the intrinsic conductivity simply goes down gradually. The difference between a semiconductor and a metal, however, is complete and distinct. In the case of a metal, there are carriers present even at zero temperature, to be explained later. It's a different situation. But a semiconductor is really an insulator, except the temperature is so high, it's beginning to have some carriers and to break down. Diamond at a high enough temperature would evaporate. Would possibly conduct a little bit. I know, for example, that glass silicon dioxide is a conductor at sufficiently high temperatures. You know, if you have a furnace with glass tubing with nice connections on it, and you want to heat it up and do an experiment with the hot tube with the metal connections, then you discover that it is a conductor. You see, I have done some experimental work and learned something from it. Now, it's interesting next to discuss the properties of these materials in more detail. First of all, I'd like to discuss the behavior, let's say, of the electrons, the negative carriers. The positive carriers have a similar, complicated, different, but similar complications. We'll just discuss one. The band structure is more complicated than the one-dimensional situation that we drew, in which we drew a band that looked like so. Actually, it's a rather complicated state that's involved, and the band energies have a curve that looks more like so, so that the minimum appears off-center here. However, if we calculate about the minimum, it doesn't make any difference where it is in the k-space if we plot about this point. Next, the system is three-dimensional, so that these minimum points where the electron moves about are not only in one place but in different directions in the crystal lattice. And if I had to draw an ellipsoid to represent the position of constant energy, see, suppose I say I take a little finite energy, where is this in K space? The first slide, for which I must recover the string, indicates how it looks in the case of silicon. The electrons in silicon have, when they have nearly zero energy, have in the space of k's, kx, ky, and kz, energies in these locations, the values of k in this location, and the ellipsoids represent constant energy surfaces for just a little bit of energy above zero, above the minimum of the band. The fact that it's an ellipsoid is analogous to the situation if it were in the center, that when we would plot it as a function of k, it would have a different coefficient for coefficient of kx squared, ky squared, and kz squared. And so the mass, the effective mass of electrons moving in different directions is different. But in addition, you can have electrons here, 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 or here. The structure of the bands in for the holes is still more complicated. Now, there is an interesting experimental way to determine the mass of the effective carriers, and to determine, in fact, that the mass has an ellipsoidal character like this, and it's such an interesting thing that I discuss it. It is possible to determine the mass of a charge, can I have the lights, please, by what is called a cyclotron resonance. If a charge is moving in empty space, in a magnetic field, in a circle, then the frequency or the time it takes to go around the circle is independent of the speed, as you probably remember from somewhere. The forces to make it go in the circle is due to the magnetic field is proportional to the velocity, and the centrifugal force, well, it goes as a square and I'm lost. But anyhow, if you figure it out, it turns out that the frequency to go around, the time it takes to go around, is independent of the radius. And this is the principle on which the cyclotron is built. And then in a cyclotron, there's an electric field horizontally, which is alternate at a frequency just equal to that time it takes to go around. And so it keeps putting more and more energy into the thing. And you can observe that this is in fact happening either by finding the electrons or, if you can't get to them, by observing an absorption of energy from the system or the oscillator that generates the field. And so the same experiment can be done in a semiconductor. Here there are some complications. First, it's not a vacuum. As it goes around, it hits lattice sites and so on, so that the resonance frequency is not infinitely sharp. In fact, for many substances, it's so wide as to not be observable. But for these very, very carefully purified supercrystals, which have very few defects and very few impurities, then there is a long enough mean free path that it can get around once or twice before it hits something, and then you get a reasonably sharp resonance. However, the mass depends upon a direction of motion of the thing, and we have an interesting problem to work out the frequency for not for an ordinary classical object, but for an object whose mass varies with direction. First, let me show you the kind of what kind of a resonance one gets if one makes a run by varying the magnetic field for a given frequency on a piece of, I don't know, I'm sorry, what it is, silicon or germanium. I forgot to look at the slide caption. I know it's silicon. Now you see that there's not just one resonance as expected before, but several resonances. They are due to the holes and to the electrons. And the fact that there's more than one resonance, say, for the electrons is due to the fact that the ellipsoids are set at different angles, and also that they are ellipsoids rather than spherical, so that the frequencies depend on the masses, and the masses depend on relative orientations of the crystal and the field. If you don't mind, since the problem of calculating something with a mass which depends upon direction may be one that you've never looked at before, for your interest, I'll show you how it would look. It is best to choose the axes in a direction in which the mass is simple, that is the direction of one of these ellipsoids, say, so that m sub z, m sub x, and m sub y are different. But those are the direction of axes, rather than have the axes for proper axes for the mass in some odd angle. Let the magnetic field, if it's at an angle, be the thing that's at the angle. The energy, for example, in the case I'm going to analyze here, we'll suppose that the mass for motion in one direction is different than in the other two directions. That is the case of a round ellipsoid rather than a circular, whatever it is, an ellipsoid, instead of one of these things that's squashed in three directions. And you can, of course, no doubt, get as a problem by somebody the case when the three masses are different. At any rate, the rate of change of the momentum in the z direction, let's suppose there's a magnetic field here at some angle to the z direction, and that angle be called theta, and I'll suppose for definiteness that it's in the xy plane, because from x's and y's, it doesn't make a difference what direction. Now, the rate of change of momentum in the z direction, which, since I'm going to look for a thing which has a periodic motion, I'm going to right away say everything goes z to the I omega t, So the derivative will be I omega PZ. Now, the point is only that PZ is the mass for the Z direction times the velocity in the Z direction. That's all you have to do, is to keep track of which M goes in here. Then the forces on the other side, due to the magnetic field, are, as usual, Vx, By, Vy, Bx. And in our particular case, where only Bx exists and is B sine theta, I have this term. The next equation, that's then the first equation written here. Same, written over again. But I explain where it came from. Now, if you understand where it comes from, you can understand the other ones. The rate of change of the x component of momentum, which is now the x mass times V sub x, is the x force, which is Vy, Bz, and Vz, By, which, when you put it in for our case, becomes qb cosine theta Vy, if you sit down and worry about each component, see what's left. And the rate of change of the force in the y direction, which would be my Vy, but my is taken to be the same as mx in this particular problem, is given by qb sine theta. This comes out this way. Now we have three, we don't know the frequency, but we'll obtain the resonance by supposing that these three equations have a solution for the three unknowns V, and you've seen this before in the quantum mechanical equations or in oscillators or eigenvalues of vectors or whatever you want to call it. At any rate, the result is it has no solution unless the determinant is zero. You see, by the way, that as you learn things, you really learn much more than you think, that each time you've got something, you can find out that you can understand what somebody else is doing in a completely different field. It's the same problem we have for energy levels. So I wrote down the determinant of the coefficients, putting everything on the other side. For example, the first equation has in the z column minus I omega mz, because I put it on the other side. In the x column, nothing. And in the y column, minus qb sine theta. And so on, the real equations. Then when we take the determinant of this thing, you get a cubic equation, which is simple because one of the solutions is omega equals zero. I don't know what it corresponds to. It corresponds to the electron just sitting there or something. We won't worry about it. It's not what we're looking for anyway. And if you take out the factor omega, you find a quadratic that omega square is very simply given in terms of the masses and the angles. At any rate, the point is that by measuring this frequency for different directions, one can obtain these two masses. And thus is obtained the masses in different directions in the case of silicon, and thereby was obtained the shape of those ellipsoids that I showed in the first slide. That is not a theoretical curve, because theory is incapable of calculating such complicated things, but instead is an experimental curve. By measuring the position of those several resonances, there were several, although this gives a distinct and unique one, because although it's a square, it's the same frequency, plus or minus, a distinct resonance frequency for a given angle. There were several because there were these several ellipsoids in different relative orientations to the B field. So the next slide shows the calculated value of the frequency of resonance against the angle in degrees of the position of the magnetic field relative to one of the crystal axes. The curves have been calculated by choosing several different mass ratios until they got the mass ratio which fit the curves best. And you see that the fit is excellent and that the theory of the cyclotron resonance in these materials is quite satisfactory. This corresponds to a mass ratio of approximately 5:1 in the two different directions in silicon. These are the electrons, the effective mass of the electron. This so-called effective mass here is not effective mass. It's the following crazy thing. They took the frequency and calculated it, assuming that there was a single mass, and gave the result of the cyclotron frequency in terms of that mass rather than just plotting the frequency. It's just a funny way of putting the answer. So it's not, don't worry about the name of the vertical axis. It's really the frequency of the calculator by taking the square root here. Next. There is possible to do something else now. And to put in more electrons, negative carriers, say, than positive carriers, in the following interesting way. If we will put some valence 5 atoms in, say, the germanium or the silicon, for example, we could add arsenic to the silicon, then it turns out that at least if not too much is added, that the arsenic decides, since the lattice is so nice for valence 4, that it would prefer to be valence 4. And so it loses an electron and becomes an ion, arsenic ion plus. And it then has valence 4 and sits in the lattice just like a silicon. So what we are doing, in other words, is putting somewhere in the lattice an object, really, which has one extra charge on the nucleus. That's all. And when we bring it in, we also bring in its electron with it. And so we have this fixed nuclear charge and a negative carrier, which is then able to move around in the crystal. So by putting a certain amount of arsenic in, we are generating or producing negative carriers. However, the charge is neutralized by a background of fixed positive charges, which are located in different places. These fixed positive charges are called donor sites. And the arsenic is called a donor because it gives a negative carrier. Incidentally, of course, since this is negative and the charges are positive, it is possible for the donor to capture the electron and for the electron to sit in the neighborhood of the donor, much like a hydrogen atom or a trapped electron. But the energy to excite such a trap is only is less than a tenth of a volt and is rather small, so I will not worry about the details of those. Some of them are trapped and some of them are not, although it is important to have a complete understanding of the way the conductivities and things depend on temperature, because it depends about how many of them get out of their traps and so on. But I won't worry about that small difference in voltage, and we'll simplify the picture by supposing that all the electrons are freed or that the temperature is high enough for that to happen, although it is in fact not exactly true. In the same way, by the way, we can add instead valence 3 objects, such as aluminum to the silicon, which then again try to act as valence 4 by getting an extra electron and thus sitting in the lattice as a fixed negative charge, borrowing the electron from some other silicon atom, leaving, that is to say, really, by making a hole somewhere, which then itself can wander around, and we have the reciprocal situation as we had in the case of the arsenic. Such an atom, which yields a hole, is called an acceptor, because it accepts an electron. It depends on whether you're prejudiced and like negative charge motion better than the hole motion. But anyway, that's called an acceptor site, and so on. A crystal in which there's a much greater number of donors impurities than acceptor impurities, that is predominantly, forget about the acceptors, say, that's just been put in valence 5, is called an N-type semiconductor. And for such a material, NN is large. Incidentally, then, NP is small, and in fact is much smaller than it is even in the intrinsic material, because the product of these two must be e to the minus energy over KT, because the large number, it's like one of those chemical reactions when you increase one thing, something else goes down, and so on, in mass, law of mass action. At any rate, NP is very small, NN is large. So in such a material, we call this the majority carrier and the minority carrier, an N-type material said to have negative majority carriers. Okay, it's an elegant terminology. Now, what about the conduction? Suppose we take N-type material, and we can disregard for such a material the holes. They do very little because there are so few of them. Under such circumstances, there's a limited mean free pair. If we put an electric field across such a crystal and the negative carrier starts to move, it doesn't keep on going forever, but there's a mean time tau between collisions. But with what? With what? With irregularities in the lattice, with the very donor sites which are producing the thing, that is the impurity sites, because there's irregularities. They have a different energy when they're near that. Arsenic has got a positive charge, and so they have a different energy there, and they have a scattering or a collision due to impurities. In addition, even in a perfectly pure crystal, there would be a collision with irregularities in the lattice, which are due to thermal motion. At any finite temperature, the atoms aren't exactly lined up, but they're vibrating, and they're just slightly out of place. Being slightly out of place, they don't have exactly the same, every one doesn't have exactly the same energy. The E naught in the theory of last time varies a little bit from place to place, and thus again, the waves are not perfect, but are scattered somewhat. As the temperature rises, that becomes more important. As the impurities go down, that becomes more important. But in most materials, it's the impurity scattering which is doing, in most technically used materials, it's usually the impurity scattering which is controlling the mean free time. Under those circumstances, we have something like this. In an electric field E, if the object carries a charge, that Q sub n, the charge carried by the negative charge carrier, which is therefore the charge on an electron, QNE is the force, and QNE over m, the mass of the negative carrier, is the effective mass for whatever direction you're calculating. Let's suppose it's constant independent direction, because we're just doing it roughly. This is the acceleration. And this, when multiplied by the mean time between collisions, gives an average drift velocity that these things will drift across the material. This analysis we've studied in the first year. And knowing the drift velocity, we can find the current. The electric current, J, current density, is the number of carriers per cubic centimeter multiplied by the velocity at which they're drifting, multiplied by the charge that each carries. And so the current is given in proportional to the velocity of drift, and the velocity of drift is proportional to the electric field. And when we put it all together, we get NN, well, QN square over MN times tau times the electric field. In other words, the current is proportional to the electric field, which is known as Ohm's law. The coefficient of proportionality varies very rapidly. Well, it doesn't vary very rapidly, excuse me, with temperature, because NN is determined by the number of donors given in. There is some dependence on account of those which are trapped, as explained before, and I guess a little bit complicated. For intrinsic material, there's a very rapid variation of NN with temperature, and so for intrinsic material, the conductivity varies rapidly with temperature. If there are not only negative carriers, but also positive carriers, and you want to increase the completeness of this equation, then you have only to add the contribution, as you can probably figure out for yourself, from the positive carriers. They have a different mean free path and a different effective mass. Well, that's all that determines the conductivity. And now, the fact that there are, in fact, positive carriers or whole carriers is such a dramatic and peculiar thing. In a substance made entirely of electrons, that the objects that were carrying the electricity should be positive is a big surprise. And so, in order to verify that it is in fact the case, I would like to show, describe an experiment which demonstrates the sign quite definitely in certain circumstances. Suppose that we have a block of any kind of conductor, metal or semiconductor, and put an electric field on it so as to draw a current in this direction, J. Then there are electrons moving in this direction. If a magnetic field is now put at right angles, the drift velocity that is common to the electrons will, on average, push a downward force. And thus, they would have a tendency to push the current down, which will be opposed by charges piling up on the walls here on each side. And with a voltmeter, you can measure the potential difference across here, or what is the same thing. The electric field inside, the transverse electric field, which is built up to oppose the effect of the magnetic field. That is, there's a certain amount of an electric field built up so that the fact that the thing is drifting in the magnetic field B makes known that effect. You see, the force, the transverse force on these electrons is the combination of two, on these carriers, is the combination of two things. The transverse electric field, which is going to be built up and which we measure with a voltmeter, plus the velocity multiplied by them across the magnetic field. Or for the directions in which we're talking here, it's the drift velocity multiplied by the magnitude of the magnetic field. But this sideways force goes to zero because it builds up charges on the sides until it does. If there's any net force, that would build up current. And if we don't draw any current but measure the voltage with no current drawn, then we have zero for the net force, and the transverse field, which we then measure by the voltage difference divided by the thickness of the sample, is V drift O times B. And V drift is in accordance with this thing here, the current by 1 over the number of carriers multiplied by the charge on each. If there are two kinds of carriers, the equations are somewhat more complicated, but I will only worry about the case of one kind of carrier. It is therefore possible to measure all the quantities B, the current, and E, and get the coefficient relating the three together. This coefficient is called R, or the Hall coefficient. Notice that the sign of the Hall coefficient, well, the Hall coefficient permits us to determine the number of carriers multiplied by their charge directly. An exact analysis of this theory of collisions, in which you take into account the velocity variations with cross of that the lifetime of particles of different velocity is slightly different, and that the contribution to the Hall effect of particles moving at a different velocity in the velocity distribution is slightly different, produces a coefficient in front of this, which varies very slightly from 1, maybe from 1.1, 1.2, depending on what you assume about the way the mean free path depends on velocity. However, for all practical purposes, we can take it to be 1. The remarkable thing is that for some materials, the Hall coefficient is negative. In fact, of course, for p-type germanium, it's definitely negative. That is, if we put the, it works just like we said. The carriers are the opposite sign. Whichever way is the right way for electrons, the Hall coefficient is the opposite. For some substances, namely for p-type germanium, the original discovery of an anomalous Hall coefficient was, in fact, in metals. It was expected that in metals, the conduction is always by electrons. And it was found, I think, that for beryllium, if I'm not mistaken, the coefficient had the wrong sign. It is now fully appreciated that there can be a symmetry and that we can have the opposite situation in which there are missing electrons, so to speak, which are carrying the current in their effectiveness in the way they work. Although it is ultimately electrons which do the moving, nevertheless, the relationship of momentum and energy and so on is so inside out and backward that the net result of this kind of an analysis is to give a correct Hall coefficient of the opposite sign. Now I would like to discuss what happens if we put two pieces of germanium together, or silicon, which have different values, a different type, which are of a different kind. So let us make what is called a P-N junction, in which we have a p-type germanium touching n-type germanium. I'll make it an np junction. On this side, I'll put the n-type germanium. And just to remember what it is, I write here many n and few p. And also, there are, remember, acceptor ions here to balance the electrical charge. Donor ions, excuse me. I get mixed up on this thing all the time. Not all the time. When I prepare the lecture, I get pretty much straight now. Now, on the other side, we are going to connect this, ultimately, with a type of material which has few and many. P, and incidentally, has negative acceptor ions floating around, not floating. Fixed inside. Now, when we connect them together, what will happen? If we touch the surfaces together, what will happen? What will happen is that the electrons, which are a large number on the one side and small on the other side, will start to diffuse into the place where there are a few of them. This cannot go on forever, because if we lose too many electrons from here, we leave the positive charges behind. So what happens is that they partially evaporate into that region until they build up a difference in electrical charge of the two, a difference in electrical voltage. This is a thing that we've analyzed to a large extent in the first year for many situations. What ultimately is this, that in the deep interior of this material here, far away from the junction, the number of N's and P's must be the equilibrium number for the temperature T. And likewise, far in the back over here, it must be the same way here. What happens in between is the following. As a function of energy, I will draw these things up higher, meaning only that there's a voltage difference between the two, so that these are the bands, but there's a difference in voltage in the following sense, that there's a voltage difference phi of such a magnitude that that the ends that have to climb up to get over here, and then there is an equilibrium possible between few here and many here, so that e to the minus phi over kt, the probability of climbing this gap, is equal to the number of ends in number 1 over the number ends in number 2, where 1 and 2 are. You figure out which way. The idea is clear, though. No? N1 is the one where there are few, and N2 is the one that there are many. But knowing what these two numbers ought to be, we can determine this difference in voltage. You say, oh, that's wonderful. Now, here, temperature is equilibrium. Oh, let's see where the voltage incidentally comes from. These negative electrons, negative carriers, I've been diffusing into here, and there are some extra negative carriers in here by diffusion. There are, therefore, some positive charges left over. So I can indicate that by net positive charges here and some negative electrons here. In a like manner, incidentally, the positive ones are diffusing in the opposite direction. Fortunately, we get the same value of phi for the positive ones here as we do for the negative one. And in the same way, there may be some negative charges here, depending on the character of the materials, which is more important than the... Well, it doesn't make any difference. Anyway, we have both kinds. And so we have a dipole layer of negative and positive charge differences here, which is an electric field in this direction and so on. So it maintains a difference in voltage at finite temperature, and thus we have perpetual motion. It is only necessary to connect an electric motor to the other two terminals. And having this voltage difference will draw a current, and it's all been at constant temperature, trying to get into equilibrium, and we'll go on forever. Well, we might as well try to connect these to a piece of wire. What kind of wire? Suppose we use this kind of wire. The moment we connect it to here on the other side, it goes down the voltage on the other side. See, if we try to connect another piece of the same kind of... Well, in any electric motor, sooner or later, when you go around the complete cycle of thinking, you come back to this original material. So you go up and down a lot of steps, depending on what kind of materials you use, but the net result is no available voltage across the terminals. There is, however, a difference in voltage on these two terminals, which could be measured in several ways. For instance, the terminals could be brought to a pair of plates in a vacuum, and they will charge accumulate on the plate because of the difference in voltage. Then if you move the plates, the charge should vary, and you can measure the varying charge by moving such plates. That's called the contact difference in potential. It cannot be measured by a voltmeter, because the moment that you put the voltmeter wires on the surfaces, there's a new contact differences of potentials between the wires and the material surfaces, which all balance out so that across the voltage, there's no voltmeter, there's no net voltage. But it's nevertheless, there's a real voltage in the sense that it can be measured in the way I indicate, or more directly, by putting these plates, the other ends, I mean, in a vacuum, and shooting electron beam across. You'll find a deflection because there's a voltage difference across the two plates. Anything that changes the voltage difference will permit us to, we can use any changes. For example, the voltage difference depends upon the strain in the crystals. If we would make very rapid variations in strain and have a voltmeter across here, if the strain is only in this region and not at the terminals of the voltmeter, then we will find voltage differences. And thus as the strain gauges, very, very tiny, delicate strain gauges are made. Or we can vary the temperature of this junction, and of some other junction could be at a different temperature. Under those circumstances, this contact difference in voltage is different in the two different regions, and that has the general effect of generating power, because it keeps trying to pump around to straighten the thing out. And thus, we can convert heat energy into workable energy. That's a thermoelectric generator. Of course, you don't get against the second law, but you, by this time, know all the rules and restrictions of such devices. Now, another interesting possibility exists. If light is shined on this, and we make a new pair somewhere in this region between here and here where there's that strong electric field, if we make a new pair, a new extra pair on top of the equilibrium number by a light photon, so we put an electron here and a hole here, the electron is immediately attracted to this region, and the hole is attracted to that region, and we develop charges on the end terminals. And as we keep shining the light, then these electrons and holes keep separating, and we pump charge, which represents a source of power, and that is a solar cell. The solar cell works by the light in the boundary region or close to it. I must You would, of course, worry about one thing. How do you know that they have time to leak out? Maybe they collide together and recombine. And so it's important that there are two times involved in understanding all the properties of semiconductors. One of the times is the time between collisions, which is very tiny, of 10 to the minus 13 or 14 or 12 or something seconds. The other is a time for recombination of a negative and positive if they're lying near each other. And those times of the order vary a great deal, between 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the minus 7 seconds. In other words, much longer than this other tau. But both times are necessary for a complete design of devices. Next, I'd like to show you that such a junction is rectifying, in the sense that if I put a voltage across it, the current which is drawn will be unsymmetrical with regard to the sign of the voltage. Let us suppose, you see, there's an equilibrium here. There's a certain current that these things would like to, which are there bombarding this surface, which I'll call I zero from this side. There's a certain current from this side at which, if I didn't look any deeper, there are a certain current at which these things bounce against this wall. Actually, they turn around and come back most of the time, but the one-sided current is, say, I1. Actually, they turn around and come back most of the time. The only fractional amount which get through is e to the minus phi over kt, that fraction of them which have an energy above phi. So we know that this is the proportion that have that, and that this equals I0 in thermal equilibrium, under ordinary thermal equilibrium. Now, however, suppose that we raise the voltage of this by an amount, or let's say we raise the voltage of this by an amount v. Then the difference in potential is no longer phi, but is phi minus v. So the current to the left on one direction, left current, is I1 e to the minus phi minus v over kt. And the right current is I0. Still, because although the voltage is lower, it's still everything that comes to this waterfall falls down. Only if V gets to be above phi does this begin to get wrong. We won't go to such high voltages. The net current, then, is the difference between these two. This is, incidentally, I0 times e to the V over kt. And the net current is I0, a constant, times e to the V over kt minus 1. For positive V, a large increase in current. For negative V, ultimately a negative current, but very small. As this is pulled down, these things still only go one way. But as it's pushed up, it makes it easier for the many ends to go that way. The back current is determined by the density of minority carriers in the other layer, while the forward current is determined much by the voltage here and by the very large density of forward going ones. This curve looks like this as a function of V. Actually, if I included the fact that when V gets more than phi, then I have to change the formula a little bit, you'd find a saturation up here in the neighborhood of I1. This is I0. The same kind of a formula we deduced for a mechanical rectifier when we discussed the rectifier called a ratchet and pawl. And you got the same result for the same reason. However, with this device, something remarkable happens under certain circumstances. Suppose that the temperature is low, but there are nevertheless many negative carriers here and positive carriers here. And now I am putting on a negative voltage, so I'm in this region. It was discovered remarkably and amazingly that the curve had a bump in it. Suddenly a new current existed, which then disappeared. What happens is the following. Visualize the voltage difference so high that the curves look like this. So here are the holes, and here are the electrons. Now, there's a very strong voltage which says that an electron can't go over to this side, but it can. It can go over against the voltage. It cannot allow it to be in here, but it gets there anyway by the famous quantum mechanical penetration business through a gap, e to the minus some exponential. And the electrons come over here and annihilate the holes. And thus, there's a discharge of the thing or a negative current. The net effect is not by the movement of the electrons into here and then running down, but simply that the electrons annihilate the holes, which then have to be supplied from the other terminals. So we get a rising current, which isn't very interesting. However, as the voltage increases still further to this condition, then the electrons here and the holes are here, the electrons in leaking through have the wrong energy to meet with the holes, and they will not combine. So the rate of combination then goes down, and we have a current that decreases again. If you can get a current which decreases as you increase the voltage, you're very happy. It's negative resistance and permits the generation of oscillators and various other devices. So here we have a region of negative resistance. And there's a very interesting thing. It's called a tunnel diode, because the tunneling effect is the name of the quantum mechanical effect by which things get through classical barriers. Finally, the most important application of transistors is in more complicated situation than the diode, the triode. But the principles are very similar. If we build a device which has an N region and a P region and an N region, and the P region is very thin, say approximately 10 to the minus 3 centimeters, so that there's no appreciable recombination inside, then we'll have a situation in which I will just draw the levels of the negative carriers. Although there are some contribution of the positive ones, you can understand everything by thinking of just the negative one. If the thing is set up this way, this is the way the voltages look, and there are few here and many here. And this is a very thin layer. Now suppose that we have a voltage difference across the whole thing, trying to draw electrons through. Then you can see that there is a certain amount of current, namely I1 e to the minus phi over kt, the current that we mentioned before, which is equivalent to I0, which floats, well, it's I1 e to the minus phi over kt, which is able to go through here. And if they come tumbling down here where we've increased this voltage difference, they'll just keep flowing through. And so we have a certain current that goes through if we maintain a difference in voltage across here by lowering this. On the other hand, if we could decrease the height of this, then we could increase the current flow, and thus we could have a valve and control the amount of current flow from one side to the other by controlling the voltage of the central region. This can be done, for example, if we wish to lower this so as to increase the current by injecting holes. That means just putting a terminal there and putting the voltage such that positive charge will move in. Positive charges move in, decrease the potential difference here, and more current flows. And thus we have the analog of a vacuum tube. We have a valve. And this is the way the transistors work in electrotransistor circuits. There is, of course, some problems in that these holes which are put in here will annihilate electrons which are there at a certain rate called the recombination rate. If it's made low enough and if the thing's thin enough, then everything's very efficient. In fact, the good transistors have the property that only about 1% of the current which is flowing through is lost in annihilating these positive charges. This is not like a vacuum tube has a much better coefficient in that particular regard. But the advantage of this device is the very small voltage differences that are needed to make appreciable differences in the current flow. The fact that these are being annihilated all the time means, unlike the vacuum tube where it's very high impedance, where you just have to put a voltage on here, you have to really maintain a current in order to keep that potential down, and it's sort of a current-operated device rather than a voltage-operated device. But those are technicalities of the electric circuits, which I will let the electrical engineers describe to you in more detail. Finally, and as the last application of the semiconductors, I would like to give the most recent and exciting device, which is a laser. We again return to the PN junction, only this time we arrange the voltage so as to make the current flow. That is, we move this up a little bit so that electrons are moving. The PN junction isn't drawn well here. This is the junction region where the diffusion has occurred. There are positive charges, you remember, here, and negative charges here. And there are many negative carriers here and many positive carriers here. Now, as the voltage, if I apply a voltage so as to push current this way, both the negative carriers move in this way, and the positive carriers move this way. And if this time I arrange things so that the recombination rate is not too small, it is possible that they recombine. And in recombining, emit their energy in the form of light. So if I put the correct voltage sign on there, the things will come together and recombine with the emission of light. This entire region is a very small, thin region inside the semiconductor, but the light which is emitted by the atom, the recombination in one place, stimulates the rate of emission in some other place, so that the recombination then becomes controlled by the light itself. In fact, I'm sorry, I indicated you want a material for which recombination probably is high. You don't. You want it so that the recombination emits light all the time, as best as possible, and that no other mechanisms interfere. Now then, if we then would shine the light of the correct frequency in one end of this thing, it would enhance the rate of annihilation of these pairs and would then generate light in the same state by the usual square root, the n factor, that when there are Bose particles, you get a greater rate of emission when there's several present. That makes more present than more present, so that the light that comes out is much more intense than the light that goes in. That's a light amplifier. Then by putting a mirror here and here, in other words, merely by polishing the crystal on either side, we can make the light bounce back and forth several times, and the amplifier has become an oscillator, a self-generator, a generator of light or infrared. May I make several remarks. First of all, it turns out that the efficiency of these things are much higher than any other laser. They're up to about 90% of the energy, and it's so easy to control because there's nothing but a voltage. Secondly, however, the disadvantage is now that this layer is so thin, that they're so narrow, that the diffraction is high, so that the beam is not characteristically so sharply in one direction as with rubio gas lasers. One remark is that this is done, and it's interesting to understand quantum mechanically, so again, I have to ask you for half a minute extra. It's done in germanium arsenide because in germanium arsenide, the bands that I indicated in silicon that are so complicated are much simpler. They're both at 0K, both top and bottom bands. It is necessary in the emission of light that the K values of the upper and lower band be nearly equal. Why? Let's see. If an electron is in a state with a given K, that means that the amplitude to be in the succession of positions across the thing vary in phase. Let's say there's one here, the 30 degrees, 60 degrees, 90 degree phase differences. In the lower state, or the hole into which it's going, if the phase difference is, now, let's suppose that the phase difference is different, then the light that comes in has a certain amplitude to knock it down at this point, or at this point, or at this point, or at this point, but all those amplitudes will interfere because their phase differences are different. But if the phase differences for the K space, for the final state is the same as it is for the initial state, then the destruction by the light at every point, because the light has such a long wavelength, it does whatever it does at the same phase everywhere, will work in unison at all the different places in the crystal. And so it was necessary first to get a material in which the K space is opposite on each side in order to make the germanium work. I want to emphasize that you are now in a position to understand a large amount of these technical devices, and I have made some references to some chapters, for example, in Cattell on the theory of the solid state for those who want more details. Thank you very much. All right, it's faster. Yeah.
I would like to give you an invitation to our faculty party at the Abbott House.
Well, thank you. When is it?
It's a week from this coming Saturday. Your wife, right?
I think we could. I don't know. Yes.
Okay,
I'll talk to my wife and find
I
out.
What's next lecture then?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
What temperature does glass start to come?
I don't remember the temperature. It's when it becomes color, when you can see it sort of reddish or whitish hot. I remember that, but I don't remember the temperature. When it begins to emit, you know, it's sort of whitish hot, nearly, yellow, reddish.
Do the semiconductor lasers use gallium arsenide?
I'm sorry, I made a mistake. It should be gallium. Yeah, I forgot to explain that. That's, it's 3.5. Which averages to 4. This was a mistake. That's a terrible error, but I have to correct it. Yes, it's 3.5. It goes in the same ladder. At the end, I get too much in a hurry. Yeah, it's gallium. Gallium is valence 3. Yeah, they're on each side of the periodic table. Yeah.
Silicon, where the hell's germanium?
Germanium, gallium arsenide, yeah. I didn't get to this, so you're going to have to worry about it. I have to still learn how much time I have. I'm out of practice.
But I just about made it today with a half a minute.